Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi there, welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing. Today is Thursday, November 11th. I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined today by U.S. political correspondent Jacob Magid and environmental reporter Sue Sirks. Jacob, we're going to get started with you. You were in Las Vegas at the Republican Jewish Coalition's annual leadership conference. What were some of your major take-homes from that conference? And the big question would be, are they going to be supporting Trump again? What can you tell us?
So I'd say I think there were about 700 people there, and people came pretty fired up with the gathering taking place just days after some very strong Republican performances in a number of elections last week, namely Republican Glenn Youngkin, who had an upset victory over Democratic incumbent Terry McAuliffe in the Virginia gubernatorial race. Now, Youngkin had a careful strategy where he ran on Trump's issues, but used some of Trump's rhetoric in terms of the 2020 election and questions about whether there was fraud, but also kept the president at an arm's length and refused to campaign on him with him. And this strategy is what some in the Republican Jewish Coalition leadership are seeking to replicate moving forward in the 2022 midterms. I think there's a realization among a few of them that I spoke with that the suburban voters that Trump scared away in 2020 will return to the party as they did last week in similar elections if you don't run on Trump. Now, Trump spoke at the conference, but he was only in a pre-recorded message, which was not really even publicized ahead of time, as if to suggest, according to one person I spoke with, that they kind of are not embarrassed by him, but they're not looking to really emphasize Trump too much. However, this was really not the majority opinion among those I spoke with. Views seem to be quite split, with many I spoke to kind of saying that Trump is still the leader of the party, is the reason for a lot of the gains that they've made among minorities, and will be key to continuing those gains in coming elections. And this split you kind of saw among speakers. There was a former governor, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was also a rumored candidate for president, who said the party would not be able to win in 2022 and 2024 if it continued dwelling on what happened in 2020. He didn't mention Trump specifically, but it was clearly aimed at him. Then again, there was Boris Epstein, the former special advisor to the president, who said that the opposite, basically, that you can't win in 2022 unless you get to the bottom of what happened in 2020. So there's definitely a rambunctious debate in the party of how to move forward. And there's the conference was kind of seen as this, that when Ari Fleischer, the former White House press secretary, called it a kosher cattle car for presidential candidates who come and strut their stuff is the phrasing he used. That's not my phrasing. There was Nikki Haley was there, and Ron DeSantis, Florida governor and the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and Ted Cruz, several candidates that are rumored to be interested in 2024, who kind of focused on their own records as opposed to Trump.
I mean, Jacob, did it feel like this was like a bunch of decision makers or followers, or, you know, what was sort of the sense in terms of who are the people who come to this and what kind of influence do they have?
A lot. This is definitely seen as the place you want to be if you're considering a future presidential run. But not only, I think there were a ton of candidates for congressional spots in 2022 that were there who know very little about the issues relating to Israel, issues that Jewish Republicans voters care about, but they do know that it's a good place to be, not only because I think you want the support of these groups, but also the support is in terms of financial support. There were quite a few donors. This is the leadership of the Republican Jewish Coalition, and hundreds of major donors were there. So I think people are looking for campaign support. And what was interesting is that while the RJC kind of talked about it, 2022 is not about Trump, Trump's not running, he's not the issue, every candidate I spoke to identified themselves as either the Trump candidate or the anti-Trump candidate. So I think people are having a hard time moving past him, even if they want to.
Right. Makes sense. I can understand that. And what kind of other conversations were you having on the sidelines? What are the other topics that are being that were being discussed there?
Sure. I met with Senator Rick Scott and Senator Ted Cruz for what happened to be a joint interview with the two Republican senators. And I asked Rick Scott specifically about what he thinks that Republicans flipping the House and the Senate next year as likely expected, would mean in terms of Israel policy. And Scott kind of said that he thinks that Congress will then be able to pass anti-BDS legislation. Now, we hear a lot about various states in the U.S. that have passed these kinds of laws outlawing or punishing companies that boycott Israel, but there actually hasn't been any federal legislation passed, as it's been stalled in Congress due to concerns by Democrats in recent years that it's encroaching on people's free speech rights, that they should, even though Democrats say they oppose BDS, Biden himself says he opposes BDS, at the same time, they don't feel it's right to tell people whether they can or cannot support such a movement that's within their confines of free speech. So Scott thinks that if Republicans get majorities in both houses, then they'll be able to pass it. Now, this wasn't the case before when they had that those kinds of majorities, and the president would still need to sign off on this legislation unless there's a two-thirds majority to override such a veto. But he was pretty confident that wins will allow for such legislation to pass. Cruz talked about he was just more focused on the Biden administration. He criticized their efforts to quote-unquote refund the Palestinian Authority. I asked him what he means by that, given that the Palestinian Authority, according to U.S. law, is not allowed to get any funding. The Biden administration is actually just funding humanitarian organizations on the ground until the PA changes its policy of welfare payments to security prisoners, including ones with blood on their hands for killing Israelis. But Cruz says that the money is fungible, that even though it's going to USAID, the State Department's humanitarian arm, that somehow the PA is getting this, which I'm sure would be welcome news to the PA if it was true that they're able to get money from the U.S. because they could use it.
So he was sort of just talking.
Yeah, depending on who you ask. I think the other main point that he made was about the consulate that the U.S. is seeking to reopen in Jerusalem that was shuttered by Trump, that existed for decades, kind of served as the de facto representative mission to the Palestinians. He said that basically what Biden really wants to do is return the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. But because he can't do that, he's seeking to elevate Palestinian claims to the city. And that is quite a popular talking point at this conference. Who were all conference goers were quite opposed to Biden's plan to reopen the mission in Jerusalem, and definitely gearing up to be quite a major fight with Republicans kind of leading the opposition to it.
Right, which you've already been reporting on that. Okay, that's interesting. So you're saying that basically Ben and Jerry's was not served at the conference?
No, there were quite a few boos at Ben and Jerry's. I think it was Governor Chris Sununu from New Hampshire who said that he would never eat Ben and Jerry's again.
Ooh, them's fighting words. All right. We're still eating it here in Jerusalem as long as they're still delivering it here. Okay. And then you also wrote about the fact that former U.S. envoy to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, who you mentioned was at the conference, criticized pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC for hosting politicians who support the Iran nuclear deal, which you need to unpack for us because it's a complicated thought.
Sure. Sure. So she really opened her speech. I think this is the main theme, or her main goal of the speech was to make these comments right off the bat, basically saying that she loves the Republican Jewish Coalition as opposed to other Jewish groups out there, such as J Street, which gives a big hug, quote unquote, to Palestinian Authority President Abu Mazen, and AIPAC, which also support or welcomes to its conferences people who support the Iran nuclear deal. And she said that AIPAC should stop rewarding bad behavior. It only encourages more bad behavior. Now, this is quite significant, I thought, given that the DC lobbyists work to cultivate ties with lawmakers from both parties to leverage them to bolster the U.S.-Israel relationship. And presidential candidates have long seen the party... from both parties have long seen the AIPAC policy conference as a necessary campaign step on their way to the White House, just like the RJC has become for Republicans. But as Israel's become a more divisive issue in Washington, particularly following Trump and Netanyahu, a growing number of Democrats have preferred to distance themselves from the group. And we saw quite a few candidates on the Democratic side in 2019, the last time AIPAC held its conference, refused to attend and refused to speak. Biden and Harris were not that in that camp, and they have continued contacts with the organization, but one Democrat went as far as to call it a hate group. This is Betty McCollum, a progressive Democrat. after the AIPAC published ads against her. So that's kind of where the Democratic Party is heading. But the Republican Party likes to call itself the actual pro-Israel party. So it was interesting to see that now a candidate like Nikki Haley, who's very calculated in every opinion she's been taking in recent years as she gears up for a presidential run, thinks it's strategic and beneficial to come out against AIPAC. So not only now is AIPAC losing Democrats, and or at least seeing Democrats distance themselves from the group, but also now a major Republican voice, which I if you're AIPAC, I assume would be cause for reason for worry. Haley kind of said that she said that bipartisanship is important, but it can't be the raison d'etre, the reason for your existence. And she kind of went after AIPAC for that point. AIPAC tries to kind of keep both sides in line. And I think if they were to start saying that we won't host any supporters of the Iran deal, that would leave them without any Democrats, because that's where the party is right now. So she criticized them for that.
It's also just interesting in terms of AIPAC, which of course is still operational, but because it's now 2 years without a conference, it's sort of interesting for her to be shooting at the hip from them.
AIPAC has always had, I think, a larger than life, people think of them as this massive group of major importance, and it likely is. I mean, it definitely was earlier, but I think it's become something larger than life that's just an easy target now for both wings and the further ends of both parties that are looking to differentiate themselves from the center.
Okay, well, Jacob, thank you for that update.
Once the nation's political powerhouse, the Israeli left has crumbled. What's behind this dramatic demise? The Jewish Quarterly, the leading international journal of ideas and culture, is back again with The Strange Death and Curious Rebirth of the Israeli Left, featuring a lead essay by Anshel Pfeffer and pieces by Raphael Zarum, Lauren Elkin, Richard J. Evans, and more. The Jewish Quarterly, issue 246, is out now. Available at good bookshops and newsagents, or subscribe now at jewishquarterly.com.
Now let's turn to Sue, who has finally left the climate conference in Scotland. What were the highlights for you of the conference of COP26? What were the takeaways? What's the likelihood of things coming to pass as a result of this climate conference?
You know, I think one of the incredible things about being there was knowing that you're there with tens of thousands of people who really want to move this thing along. Good people, a lot of good people there who are doing a hell of a lot of work. On the other hand, you realize that it's something that mankind has never faced before. It's a massive, massive system with an infinite number of cogs and elements that all has to be moved forward in sync at the same time in coordinated fashion. And there is nobody to coordinate it. It's almost superhuman. You know, when you're there listening to the finance people about what they're doing, and you're listening to the tech people, and you're listening to the just people who are working in every conceivable area of life trying to move things forward, how do you coordinate it? It's really incredible, and it's really mind-boggling. I think that you know, people keep asking me whether COP, which stands for Conference of the Parties, whether COP is going to achieve what it set out to do, which basically means limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. Compared with pre-industrial times, we are not there yet at all. And the most recent figure that came out was today or yesterday, something called the Climate Tracker, where they took all the pledges for action until 2030. And on the basis of those pledges, and forget if they're even going to be implemented, we're looking at 2.4 degrees. And that is disastrous in terms of all the things we know about, in terms of fires and droughts and flooding and all the rest of it. So now now is the really hard part. The COP, or the UN Secretariat, came out with a draft agreement, which is full of, you know, we urge and we call and we express concern and all the rest
calls
of it.
Calls for action.
Mm-hmm. It's not really pinning things down, which is very difficult because you've got almost 200 countries and they all have to agree to this thing. So the coming days are crucial, although I don't think the expectations are particularly high certainly not that 1.5, you know, that they'll come to an agreement on targets for 1.5. It will be the start of a continuing process. And one of the things that's good about the draft, whether it gets through to the final version or not, nobody knows, but they are actually calling for new targets by the end of next year, which kind of compels some of the laggers to come up with something better.
And what does it mean? In other words, you say that, you know, they're sort of forming this policy paper of a sort. Who does hold each country to it? What, each country holds the other country to it? In other words, they all
hold
each other accountable?
That's the problem. No, I mean, they are trying to develop some kind of international monitoring system, but it's extremely hard. And of course, the other thing is that the fossil fuel industry is out in force there. You know, they, according to the BBC, they are the single biggest delegation. Now, we're talking about, people say it's 100 companies in the world that are holding us to ransom. And there was a recent study done which found actually that our beloved Chevron, which is operating gas fields in Israel, is amongst the worst of all in terms of misinformation, in terms of trying to delay. The fossil fuel industry is like, you know, it's like the lion. It's like the old lion that still has a lot of roars in it. But unfortunately, you know, there is not the political will, the political ability to actually stand up to them. And so they continue to shape this thing, which is unbelievable.
Okay. So tell us, not that you have to, but tell us something good. What are the possibly positive things coming out of it?
I think there are good things coming out of it. I mean, there were a number of decisions taken over the last week or so on reversing deforestation, on cutting methane, on moving away from coal. That kind, those are all very, very important. Unfortunately, China, India, Australia are not on board. And surprisingly, the US is not on board, not on coal and not on a number of things.
Australia?
Yeah, Australia has a massive coal industry. And they are not willing to give up on that. But at the same time, you know, as an Israeli official said to me, this issue has now moved to center stage of politics, economics and everything. It's no longer an environmental issue. People understand that. There's, 100,000 people were out on the streets in Glasgow on Saturday calling for change, which is incredible.
The videos were amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I just saw today that there's a group of activists who are taking legal action to try to force the UN to declare an emergency, as they did with COVID, and to set up some kind of central body, as they did with COVID. With COVID, it was the World Health Organization. So, you know, and also the poorer nations were much more vocal, I think. You know, there was one prime minister of some little island, I forget which one, who issued his call. He was dressed up in a suit, but he was actually standing in the sea, you know, with his trousers rolled up to show the effects of rising seas. So I think that the issues are much more out there, much better grasped, perhaps, than previously. And, you know, we're going to have to be patient, which is incredibly hard because all the scientists are saying we do not have time, and that by 2030 we're supposed to cut carbon emissions by almost half. Can you imagine that happening? I mean, it's just so drastic.
Around the corner.
Yeah.
And when you, as you, you know, take your leave of Scotland and come back to Israel, you know, what will you follow up on in terms of stories? What are the stories that you're really, you know, looking to engage in and research, given what you've seen and heard over the last week?
A number of things. Firstly, the tech. I've picked up a number of stories on amazing tech that's being developed in Israel, climate tech. Secondly, on the passage of the carbon tax, which is part of the budget. It was actually interesting. I met with some of the business delegation. There was a business delegation from Israel at COP, and they were saying that they're not opposed to carbon tax. But what wouldn't be fair would be if they had to pay a carbon tax, which is reflected in their products. But if we continue importing from countries that don't have a carbon tax, such as China and Turkey. And I suddenly realized that in many ways, we've kind of outsourced our emissions to China. If you think about it, you think about Israel becoming gradually clean, But how many of the stuff, how much of the stuff that comes through on Alibaba or Amazon is actually made in China? Which is why one of the stickiest things that the UN is discussing is some kind of carbon trading market worldwide. Anyway, so our first step in Israel is to get a carbon tax. The businessman also told me that it was very hard for them to do anything green, even to green their operations, because there's so much bureaucracy and red tape and regulations in Israel. You know, one of them said they were trying to set up a solar field in the desert. Right. But they've been talking to the Israel Lands Authority for 2 years, not getting anywhere. So all of that has to change as well.
Okay. You've got a lot of work to do, Sue.
Absolutely. But it's all good and it's all important.
It is. And one hopes that, you know, we can maybe see our way through this. You hope.
Indeed.
Thanks to you both for being here today at the Daily Briefing. Reminder to sign up for Streetwise Hebrew by becoming a member of the Times of Israel community. In the meantime, we're going to sign off. Have a good day, all.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.